Hello and welcome to another episode of the Daily Remedy Podcast. Today we're here with Dr. Stefan Cortez, addiction policy physician at the University of Alabama in Birmingham. He is the principal investigator for a VA, that's Veteran Affairs-backed clinical study that focuses on opioid transitions and suicide risk. And with that, I'd like to welcome Dr. Cortez.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
No, it's our pleasure. First off, before we begin, I want to thank you on behalf of the chronic pain community, substance use dependency community, for all the work that you're doing. And it's a big light on so many voices that need to be heard. So first off, thank you so much for what you're doing.
Yeah, it matters to me a lot. So yes.
Good, good. So let's begin by discussing the clinical study, CSI Opioids. Full name being Clinical Context of Suicide Following Opioid Transition. Tell us a little bit about this study and what the focus is.
Yes, absolutely. This is a study to closely examine individual deaths by suicide that occur in people in that unique situation of having had prescription opioids stopped or reduced. And by closely examine, I mean look really closely, like the way we explore an airplane after it's crashed and try to understand all the things that went wrong at the same time. And the reason we think that we need to closely examine these is that I've come to feel that the studies that use large database statistics are not helping us to understand why these tragedies occur and when we might actually be harming patients and what would make the difference between harming and helping. So there has been, you know, there have been plenty of reports of people who died by suicide after a prescription opioid change. There are lots of large database studies, some of which say, hey, this risk looks like it might be elevated, but not for all people, and maybe not for these people, but yes for those. But those databases are all pretty incomplete, and they leave a lot of room for argument about whether on average reducing opioids contributes to a risk or doesn't, but it never really shows you what really happened in the life of an actual person. So part of it is just to understand what's really happening for these people, what's happening in these tragedies that we want to prevent, and certainly to illustrate how important it is. I think that it's become easy for policymakers and even for researchers to argue in the abstract and to kind of suggest that if I know the average effect of changing someone's prescription, I don't really need to know what happens to individuals. I can just recommend a policy. And this is a pushback and says, no, we need to understand what happens to actual people.
Thank you for clarifying that. Before we discuss the study and the data collection mechanism, I want to touch on a few points that you had mentioned. You talk about large databases not adequately representing the actual course of individual patients. And you alluded a little bit when you talked about averages. Can you expand a little bit more on large databases, this tendency towards averages, and why that often underrepresents individual patients?
Yeah. So you can pull a database, for instance, of all the deaths in a healthcare system and pull some very standard kinds of information, like what kinds of prescriptions did the people receive and what kinds of diagnoses were assigned to those people at some point in time by doctors when they received health care. And someone can then take all that stuff and crunch it into a database and say, gosh, you know, if the prescribed dose is higher, there's a somewhat higher risk of overdose death. But they don't really know when the overdose happened or whether the person who died actually died of the prescribed dose or of something else. Medical record systems are terribly incomplete and they just don't reveal what actually happened. And on the suicide front, there have now been, depending how you count it, 3 or 4 studies that seem to show a hint of an additional suicide risk after prescription opioid reduction. But we know that doesn't happen for everybody. Some people feel better and some people feel worse. And the difference between those things is completely unclear from these large databases because they don't collect very refined information. So at a certain point, everyone finds it easier to do these large database studies and to argue about statistics. And this leaves us blind in regard to catastrophic events that merit and deserve much more respect and time than any researcher's been willing to give them. And average effects, I should say this, imagine that overall reducing prescription opioids somehow reduced the risk of death, but inadvertently kills a certain number of people. Okay, that could be I'm just hypothesizing. So what if something is overall on average helpful, but sometimes kills people? Do you just say, okay, so we're just going to do that thing and accept the consequence that occasionally will kill our patients against their will? Probably not. We probably need to understand the difference between situations where we help people and harm people and try to avoid harming and try to improve helping. But we'll never get there unless we look at individual situations.
Well said. I want to touch on that point and play devil's advocate a little bit.
Good.
In a recent article you wrote in Sensible Medicine, you cite a few policy review articles that hint at a decrease in opioid prescription dosage and an increase in suicides. But you mentioned there are confounding factors that prevent an A to B correlation or an A to B understanding, to maybe talk in more broad terms. I know this is a Byzantine argument that has layers upon layers, but as simply as possible, can you talk about these convoluting factors and why so many conversations lead to these kind of almost kind of echo chambers of arguments?
Yes, absolutely. So clinicians are not perfect, but they often change their prescriptions in response to something that makes them feel concerned. So if I'm prescribing opioids to a patient and that patient shows some volatility in terms of how they interact, maybe they shout at the front desk, they don't show up for an appointment, and then they come in some sort of crisis and they say they took more pills than I expected them to take, that's a moment of volatility. And that moment of volatility might trigger the doctor to say, oh, I can't prescribe anymore, I'm going to stop, and because I don't know what my risk is, I don't know what's going on. And that volatility itself, even before the doctor made the decision, that might be a sign that that person was becoming suicidal. And the clinician's prescription change might not be the key factor in those instances. So in all these large database studies, they never know that. They never know what happened right before the clinician made their change. So they might find that a prescription reduction is associated with a risk of suicide afterwards, but it might be that the clinician is changing their prescriptions wisely or unwisely in reaction to a sign that things are already going badly for the patient. And that's why the statistical arguments always kind of fail. Like you can't know all these things that really might have influenced doctors' behavior. Of course, do I believe some prescription reductions cause actual suicide? I suspect so, because I feel like I've seen that happen. But I just don't think the large databases will show it. And we have to get individual cases and try to show what's the interplay between clinician actions and what's going on with the patients.
Well said. So let's transition to the actual study itself.
Sure.
And you had mentioned lived experiences. And at various points, you've talked about the quality of the data. Can you expand on how you will collect data in this study and why it's so unique?
So first of all, there's not going to be a perfect story. There's not going to be a perfect way to know what God would know, if you believe in God, of all that went into a person's life. But what we will collect and what we're seeking is, first of all, initial survey information from a person who wishes to come forward voluntarily and who was very close to the person who died, preferably a family member or a close friend. And we're going to survey that person. There's an initial survey that's about 45 questions long that you can do right now if you know somebody at our study website. And then there's an in-depth interview combined with survey that we would do with the same individual. And this in-depth description asks some standard questions like, do you know if they had mental illness? How confident are you about what actually happened at the end? Why do you think it might be a suicide? Why do you think it might not be? It allows people to say, I'm not sure. What do you know about their pain medications? What do you know about whether they had mental diagnoses at the same time? Do you know if the individual felt like they were a burden to others before the time that they took their own life? Do you know if they felt included in activities? Do you know about their disability? So we try to form a rich portrait based on the report of a proxy, a person who knew them well. At the same time, and that requires some statistical analysis, but also the interviews are qualitative in nature. Just if you imagine studying an airplane that has crashed, people look at every part they can look at. Now, here we're not looking at the body of somebody who died. We're looking at as rich a portrait as we can get from a proxy. We will supplement that with medical records whenever they are obtainable. So if the individual has authority to request medical records or can help us find the person who does have authority, we'll request those records. And then you form a rich portrait of each death. You know, I actually, long time ago, I actually did autopsies in a department of pathology as a medical student. And you would examine a body and you would look at tissue and then you would look at the story in the medical chart and try to form a narrative. Why did this person die at this time? How did that happen? And in the end, it's an act of interpretation. Even when you're looking at the actual body and its death from a medical disease, there still is a moment of interpretation. You say the best synthesis of why this death happened at this time seems to be this constellation of factors. And that's the kind of portrait we want to form for 110 to 120 suicides.
One of the questions that may arise would be that of credibility. Mm-hmm. How do you know what you're hearing is true? Can you talk a little bit about the verification mechanisms?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think what's going to happen is that, I mean, we ask, first of all, a study has to be done in a way that invites disclosure and assures the individual that there's room for them to express uncertainty, that the investigators are not exercising judgment, and that the investigators are not going to simply try to make a political argument out of what happens from their data. So we have to earn the trust of every person who engages with us, that there's confidentiality, that the data are secure and won't be released to anybody in any identifiable way, and that we are in a good faith exercise with them, and it allows people to express uncertainty. So we have to optimize those conditions. Above and beyond that, there will be a subset of cases where we can get the medical records. The medical records are not authoritative either. It's not like we know that doctors write all kinds of incorrect things in records. However, there will be a subset of cases where we can establish with greater confidence perhaps what happened to prescriptions in particular. And then we can compare what's the storyline that we seem to see in those cases where information from the medical record does align with what we heard from the proxy. And how different an impression do you get when you look at the other kinds of cases where we don't have a medical record or where they don't align? And ultimately, a team, a multidisciplinary team that includes doctor, medical anthropologist, pharmacy experts, opioid experts, and suicide experts, and people from the affected population, the team has to look at those cases and say, what do we think is making sense out of this? It's a qualitative exercise. And the goal is not to create a statistical portrait, but rather, what is the most trustworthy insight we can offer regarding these events? Ultimately, it's our qualifications and our process and the security of the relationship we form with an individual that should allow that result to be trustworthy. That does not mean it will be true in every instance of life, but it will be something that no one else is trying to do at this time.
That's amazing, and it's one of the most innovative study designs that I have heard of in a long time. Could you go through an example? Let's say we have patient X died by suicide following an opioid transition. Talk through the mechanism of how it would be evaluated, the databases you would glean information out of, and how various individuals of different backgrounds would look at the data and draw extrapolations from that.
Sure. So I'm thinking of, you know, we've been running a pilot version of our survey, a 45-question survey that people can go to even now. I think the website is go.uab.edu/CSIopioids. There's an online survey, and a lot of people checked it out and then decided not to proceed with it. So several hundred people have accessed it, and about 50 or 60 people have responded. And initially, we ask four basic questions. You know, is the person in the U.S.? Are you in the U.S.? Are you over 19? And do you believe that someone died by suicide after a change in opioid prescription? That's an initial question. Just do you believe? And then later, as they go into it, We solicit information about where the reporter is and what their relationship is to the individual who died. How close were they? What do they know about the person who died? What do they know about their pain history? It's just as survey questions. And there's a specifically level of confidence in regard to opioid prescription reduction. And we have rules just for evaluating the responses to a series of three or four questions about the medication change to try to figure out who are the people who are most confident that there was an actual reduction in medicine. Because some people don't know, or they say it went up and then it went down and then went up again. That's what we're already seeing. We also ask them to assess the suicide and what led them to think that a suicide was an intentional action versus not, and that conclude how it was done and whether there was a note and things like that. From those cases that appear most likely to represent both a reduction and a suicide, we reach out to, we haven't begun this yet, we're setting these contracts in place to do the next step, which is to reach out to those people to do a more elaborate informed consent. There's even some modest payment for participation, both for working with a medical records team that will try to get records from around the country in collaboration with that individual, and also to have an in-depth recorded interview. The interview has, we've done a couple of pilot versions, and I'm just thinking of a possible example of a type of death that's come up. So in one case, we did a pilot interview with somebody where the individual had long-term chronic pain. They had multiple life problems. They had been rejected by their family. And they received information from their doctor saying, I won't be able to treat your pain. But there was some uncertainty as to whether there had been prescription opioids ongoing before they got that information. And then the individual, you know, the reporter also said to talk to us about how that individual had been rejected by many parties across their life and actually made to feel like a burden to friends and to family and to the healthcare system, and just had only a few friends. And so the collision, the model that we brought to the thinking about this case, and we haven't drafted a report since it was just a practice interview, is a person had been traumatized across their life in part by feeling like they were a rejection and by being a burden. They had very severe pain, and we had some medical diagnoses from the interview. There was a report that I will not be able to treat your pain. But we had to assign in that particular instance uncertainty as to whether there were opioids that were given or opioids that were stopped. And that was a practice case, and we won't be using it for the final analysis. But if we were, hypothetically, we would say, you know, this theme of having been told that you are difficult, that you're a burden, being rejected by even early in life by family and then later by the healthcare system is a kind of trauma theme. And it involves trauma that spans way back in time, not just at the time of the healthcare relationship. And we would then say, how many other situations in our interview library, which we hope to get to 110, involve that kind of rejection over time? The idea of having had actual trauma in life is a common one in suicide stories. And then there's a body of scholarship by a member of our study team named Thomas Joyner, and they focus on something called perceived thwarted belongingness, which means that you want to belong, but you are not seen as being worthy of belonging, and you are aware of that. And then there's a second theme that has come up in suicide literature elsewhere in the world called perceived burdensomeness, which is the view that your loss, that your existence is now a burden to others, and you don't want that to happen. So what we'll ask is, in how many of these 120 cases are there these things, trauma, thwarted belongingness, perceived burdensomeness? I have to highlight impasses in healthcare. That's one I'm extremely interested in, because in the individual situations I've had the chance to read medical records about, I see impasses where doctors close the door and say, I can't do anything now. Even in the case that made the news, where there was a lawsuit, again, there was an impasse. We're doing this, no change. We can't do anything other than this because we're required to. So where we find themes like belongingness, trauma, the speed of the medication change, maybe that'll be an important thing, other coexistent illnesses, these then become themes that we highlight in our reports. And we say, here are five of the themes that come up. But among those, some of them are actionable by health systems. That's the key, right? healthcare providers and healthcare systems could choose to take these things more seriously. They could say, we want to watch out for impasses in pain care for people who are on long-term opioids. Of course, I would say that for the last 6 years, even without my study, but it may be a more powerful form of evidence if you can find those impasses, which are then followed by a traumatic change and a loss of life. It may be that the speed of a prescription opioid reduction is a key factor. I don't know that yet.
All of those factors that you alluded to, as I was hearing them, I almost started piecing together the lives of patients, the lives of those who have been affected by both policy changes and legal changes in the overdose crisis. And it's hard to ignore the legal and policy implications of your study. And as you know, Dr. Cortez, you've faced some of that directly and indirectly. Talk a little bit about the stigma surrounding this study and what potential implications that may have for study participants.
I think that there's probably more than one layer when we use the word stigma or perception. So first of all, prescription of opioids has gone through its own wave of both being embraced and then stigmatized. And then separate from that, suicide is itself a stigmatized event. Finally, I think people may have internal lines of resistance and concern to actually asking why a death happens. So I'll take those in sequence. Prescription of opioids was embraced for a period of time, probably in an uncritically open way, probably from the 90s to 2012 when those prescriptions peaked. A lot of doctors, I think, had some mixed feelings about that, but probably said, look, you know, people are saying this is something I should do, or it's okay, I can do more than I might have initially suspected. And then because of many of us, I mean, I felt I was trained a bit, but not a lot, in pain and addiction as the problems emerged and as society got angry. A lot of doctors, they just want to stay in practice and said, look, I don't know what I was doing before, but I'm getting out of this now. This apparently is a bad thing. So a lot of doctors then turned the historic suspicion of people with long-term disability and the historic suspicion of opioids and the historic suspicion of addiction and dependence and said, I don't want to be part of this. I don't want to touch this. I don't want to touch those people. And the further away I can get, the better. And frankly, they were encouraged to take that view by people who wanted to do good, who wanted to change, maybe pull us back from excessive prescribing, but also by the litigants and opioid litigation and by journalists who felt that this was a simple story and we were giving out opioids like candy, and we all know that giving away too much candy is a bad thing, except on Halloween. Now we have to take away the candy from the bad people. And that is an easy stigma story that enfolds a bit of stigma around addiction, our own lack of education, and a collective social revulsion to the actual harm we did by overprescribing. I don't want to say we didn't. We did. But then the next step is that suicide itself is a stigmatized event. So when somebody dies by suicide, people say they're concerned, but at the same time, there's a sense that, you know, those people live in a kind of morally ambiguous box. And there are ways in which death by suicide involves a tragedy for everybody involved. And we just don't always want to go there. We don't always want to look at what happens at that. And then there's a collision of those things. The first time I suggested, as I began to hear about suicides, that the first time I said, we need to study the individual deaths. An individual actually stood up in a public meeting. She's actually from an organization called Farmed Out, which is about pharmacy having excess influence. And she said, no, you don't have the reason, you don't have the rationale, you don't have sufficient evidence to justify studying the deaths of patients under these circumstances. And it was pretty audacious. There's a video of me on YouTube kind of looking kind of shocked and trying to figure out how do you have this conversation? Like, I just say, I'm a doctor. I used to do autopsies. I want to study these deaths. And you're saying we shouldn't. But at that moment, even the idea of studying these deaths and looking at them was seen as a threat to a simplified narrative that had some about overprescribing, that if you were to say that people died in this context and say, I want to understand it better, that alone was seen by some as a threat to correcting and rationalizing some historical errors in prescribing. That assumes the worst about everybody involved, including me, that we couldn't learn and figure out how to do something better without just being shills for the pharmaceutical industry. By the way, I have no relationship to the industry. But that seems to me a terrible sign of stigma. So I think that those are the layers there. And then, of course, yeah, once you say I'm going to look at these deaths, I remember the first time we reported our pilot study in 2020, we put up the survey, and the journalist felt obliged to contact a faculty member at Stanford University named Anna Lemke, who I know. And in our local newspaper, having read the press release explaining the survey, she condemned the study and explained that we were simply going to try to prove that reducing opioids causes suicide. And I knew her, so I wrote to her. I said, Anna, you know, I'm available to you. I can give you information about our study whenever you like. As it is, you spoke from a press release and provided inaccurate information about us. Why don't you reach out to me in the future? And she wrote back and said, well, you're probably right. But I felt I had to go off the press release, and that's all I had, so that's what I used. And, you know, it bears mention that the individual who I know was involved in the opioid litigation and had a stake in an argument. We all have stakes in arguments. But in the end, what we should want is to get the best possible insight about how to prevent the death of people who we take care of.
Why do you feel there is this tendency to simplify and other people who may not necessarily share the same exact view, particularly when it comes to addiction, suicide, pain? There's a unique tendency to simplify this aspect of medicine, and I'm curious to glean your thoughts on that.
I think it might go broader than this, because to some extent, all of us need heuristics to understand how to get through the day. Like, when I do things automatically, even in clinic, I see somebody who's breathing a little hard, I start to think asthma, heart failure. I'm using heuristics, I'm making quick judgments. So to some extent, all of us take shortcuts just to survive. I don't, you know, when the light turns green, I don't really analyze how sure am I that that's a green light versus a red light. I just hit the accelerator. So there is a way in which it's a human tendency. I think it's probably worse in domains where we have, where we can't see what's going on inside people, and where we have emotional judgment of and fear of being judged ourselves. So we can't see what's going on inside people with pain or with addiction or dependence or something in between. We are troubled sometimes by what we see. It can be hard. It can feel hard to us as human beings, not just as doctors. And we also feel implicated, like we could make it worse, or we could make it better, or we might be to blame. So if you add potential for self-blame, not knowing what's going on inside people, and the fact that people with complex problems can be exhausting. I mean, just honestly, when somebody is under stress and maybe making bad assumptions about me as a doctor, they think I'm not a good person, or they tell me you're not a good person, and I'd like to believe I am, but you know, we can discuss whether I really am. But if you're feeling uncomfortable and someone's making you feel uncomfortable, and there's a shroud of mystery and society is screaming about a crisis, I want a shortcut. Anybody human would say, get me a shortcut out of this problem. And a quantitative analysis that makes it seem like this is going to be an easy problem to solve is a shortcut. And yeah, you have to be a little bit obsessive and a little bit crazy to say, I'm not going to take the shortcut. I'm going to dive in, really try to understand. And in some ways, our team is indulging a little bit of obsessiveness on this issue, but I think it's needed here.
You mentioned throughout our conversation this notion of uncertainty, and that belies a certain complexity to the overall issue. Deaths by suicide, addiction, dependency. Do you feel that by chronicling data in the way that you are doing that it may be difficult to make a general consensus interpretation out of, or you would argue that's the point?
Well, first of all, I think they're likely to be correctable things that if you look at 110 cases of any tragedy and you find 20 in which the same precursor problem arises, health systems have to stop and say, okay, we can't just ignore that. That doesn't mean you know that it's always the cause of the problem. But if 100 airplanes go down and 20 of them involve a curious signal from the avionics system right before they went down, no one's going to say, you know what, we need to do a randomized controlled trial of avionics signal abnormalities before we fix it. No, you say, okay, when you get this curious signal from the avionics signal before an airplane goes down, take it seriously because we've got 20 crashes and those are tragedies and they can't be reversed. So I think that you can get some statistical constancy, even if it's a qualitative study, by looking at the individual cases. There's some insight that is robust and only available by looking at individual situations, but it's when you find a constant theme across several of them. Distrust and trust at the time of a prescription opioid change. We won't be inside the head of the person who died, sadly, but the perceptions of someone and what they shared with others at the time that they were spiraling toward a disaster are worth knowing. The ideas I mentioned earlier, thwarted belongingness, which is a theme in all suicide literature, perceived burdensomeness, another theme. Those are things that emerged over long-term studies repeatedly. So I don't think the result of our study is every life is complicated. I could tell you that now. I think there's going to be common themes that no one can get any other way.
As a PI, you always want to maintain a certain neutrality when it comes to the outcome of the study itself. But in designing a study, you have to be aware of implicit moral hazards or how the data is intended to be used and not intended to be used. Can you talk a little bit about some of those thoughts?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that this is a remarkably complicated situation because in the abstract, I don't think it's good. In the abstract, I would have said, it would be helpful, Stefan, if you had never been an advocate on the issue of involuntary opioid reduction before you proposed to study the matter. Because I agree that there is a commitment that I've already declared in this domain that speaks to some aspects of the study. So there is a risk. That's part of the story, and it can't be set aside. What is important is to begin with a posture of self-scrutiny, and we designed the study partly to set aside some of the advocacy by saying, look, there are deaths. We're not going to say, we're not even going to prove that opioid reduction causes these deaths. There's a statistical signal in large databases. You want to prove something, you do a randomized controlled trial. You involuntarily reduce a bunch of people and see how many die by suicide in one group, and then you don't do it in the other and you see how many die. No one will ever do that study because it's unethical. So all we're going to do is expose the context in which something happened. My declaration of concern on this matter was early and to me felt like a moral necessity. It seemed to be borne out by the facts that follow. That is, over the last 5 years, the Food and Drug Administration and the CDC and HHS have all said, look, this is not an ignorable risk. So where I staked a claim turned out to be validated, that there is a concern, but it's not a very well understood one. And what we're saying is, let's try to understand in a better and in a deeper way what's going on. The other thing that is important to say is, this is one of the situations where the advocacy may actually be prerequisite to having to being able to do the study. And it's the opposite of what I would have expected. But people who are subject to incredibly stigmatized mistreatment and distrust include people in the pain community who very often know others who died by suicide or are considering it. They're already used to being screwed by the healthcare system and viewed with distrust and belittled and minimized by nearly every policymaking body. So when a quote-unquote researcher says, hey, we're going to study your problem, they have every reason to say, sorry, we're not available for exploitation for your publication and your career development. Having done some advocacy, as I've tried to, in a way that I think stuck with the facts, and I must say I've tethered my advocacy always to where the evidence is, but having actually stuck one's neck out begins a conversation with a group of people who have every reason to distrust academic researchers. So if you look at our website now, the study website, even now, it explains the purpose of the study, but it does have a tab on our advocacy and who we've collaborated with to speak on behalf of the population. And it has a frequently asked questions section, which announces every question that we've received from others, including skeptical ones, like, you know, how are you going to help me? But I think in this one instance, just to step back, and you can cut this if you need to, but how do you get access to people who died by suicide under particular circumstances? There's no registry that can just be raided and then you can go knock on doors and say, hey, we heard you know somebody who died by suicide. A, it's creepy. B, the registry doesn't exist. So you have to go to the public. You have to say, if you want to speak to us of your own accord, we're here. But they have to have a reason. They have to believe that you're a credible actor. And in this particular situation, it turns out that the things that I felt were ethically necessary 5-6 years ago may help make the case that we're worthy of being trusted. And that doesn't mean we're going to deliver a result that aligns with somebody's agenda. It won't. It'll be something honest to the data. But we're starting from a position of having taken a moral stand on how people should be treated.
It's very interesting. And in many ways, I can't help but draw parallels to the pandemic, whether that's a belief in COVID as an actual viral condition to the efficacy of the vaccines. Do you see cognitive similarities in the arguments that took place in the pandemic that may lend additional credibility to how you're performing your study?
I'm thinking about it. I need you to lay it out a little bit more. What are the parallels that are coming to mind for you?
The fact of trust being a determining factor in patient behavior. That really comes to mind when I look at how you're conducting this study and how you plan to recruit for this study. It's less about the absolute strength of data and more about the trust in procuring data and then determining what the validity is as it pertains to your study methodology. In the same vein, when you look at, let's say, COVID-19 vaccines or public health safety measures, regardless of how efficacious they are, there's a trust that needs to be set in the first place. And I'm curious to see if you find those parallels or if you see more differences than similarities.
Yeah, actually, I'm thinking about the CDC here for, you know, a series of message reversals early in the pandemic, messages about masks that went back and forth, don't wear them, wear them, wear, don't wear them. There is a way in which people often feared that the guidance from federal agencies was influenced by a desire to simplify or by a pharmaceutical company that's trying to sell a vaccine. Those things were not easily distinguished from raw ideology. I mean, you know, it typically often was the case that if you're a little bit more to the left, you tended to trust those authorities. And if you're a little bit more to the right, you didn't in the case of the vaccines. So the parallel there, the public trust in the entire process of going through a crisis is, in the ways in which that trust was confused at the minimum, it may be broken at times, actually is a parallel to whether people can trust any party that's speaking on a tragedy of overdoses and pain care. If you appear to be mostly advancing your own career and or monetizing your expertise to a substantial degree, people are going to at least see that as a potential reason not to trust you as an expert, as a so-called expert. The more clearly you connect your work to to honesty, to saying, well, this is what I know, this is what I don't. The more open you are to taking some criticism, and the less you're trying to monetize your interest, the more people may be saying, okay, I can indulge this conversation. I can at least listen to what this person has to say.
Well said, and thank you for your transparency throughout this conversation. I have a rather odd question, but I think it's important for those listening to get your response from it. As you know, there's a tendency to create sides with so many polarizing healthcare issues. You, among many, have tried to resist this trend of simplifying and creating sides. What goes through your mind when you feel as though somebody is pigeonholing you or as though somebody is simplifying your perspective? How are you responding to it? And what are some communication tips you can provide to find a common ground?
Well, of course, there's one level which I'm a naive, insecure, middle-aged adult. So if at the first moment of being pigeonholed and criticized, I feel hurt and want to lash out. Usually I don't, though. I sort of pause and talk with people and say, does this matter? Should I respond at all? Because sometimes your best response is your actions over several years rather than what you say in the moment, your track record. In some instances, where I respond, there are a couple things I've tried to do, and I don't always do it. I occasionally stir the pot in ways that I think later maybe weren't helpful, but usually I will offer, if I respond in social media, offer a longer response rather than a shorter one. So I might do a 10 tweet thread and I'll say, you know what, there are going to be fewer people who read this because it's 10 tweets long, but in those 10 tweets I will concede certain points that my critics have made because there's something valid about them, and I will make sure that that's on the record. And I will acknowledge why the point I'm trying to make isn't easily simplified. And there will be some who will read the 10 tweets and say, yeah, this is sophisticated. And there'll be some who won't. They'll just breeze right by. And I'll say, you know what? I'd rather be on the record saying something that respects the complexity of the issue and respects the people who disagree with me than not. Now, of course, occasionally I've broken that. And I've thought it was reasonable because the point was simple. But it also, I've sometimes either thought it was stupid after the fact or had a 20-year-old son to me say, Dad, that's dumb. He's actually smarter about social media than I am. And I thought, okay, fair point. So the other thing I've done when I think that somebody is just in genuine disagreement but is not really seeking to exploit the situation is usually those people I engage with respect. I have conversations with them. I say, I see this differently, but you want to talk about that? And over time, a number of people have said to me, originally I thought you had a very extreme view, and then later I came to the realization that your perspective was actually a coherent whole, and it wasn't quite what I thought it was at the start, and actually I think there's something worth listening to. I may not agree with you fully, but there's something to converse about. And so I would rather be honest and willing to use the words, it's complicated, and have that on my tombstone than he really burned on Twitter on my tombstone.
Yeah. No, that's well said, Dr. Cortez. And I want to thank you so much for your time and for talking to us and helping to explain this clinical study. I think that it's extremely important, and the links to learn more about the study, to potentially participate, will be made available on the YouTube site and on the podcast itself. Before we go, in terms of a few parting words, for those listening who may be interested in participating, can you talk a little bit about how they can learn more about the study and what they can do to really feel comfortable knowing that they can be forthright in this conversation?
So first of all, the study is for people who believe they've lost somebody, even if they're not fully confident as to what happened, but believe that someone has died. If you're somebody who's currently in trauma because your prescription opioids are being reduced or being threatened to be reduced, and you're not sure what's going to happen to you, we put up a separate website to help offer guidance for families on that. I want people to know that if you search for Stefan Kertész, my name on medium.com, there's a long article called "My Opioids Are Being Reduced, What Do I Do?" And that's practical guidance for people in that situation, because we've heard from many already. If somebody's thinking about the study and just wants to learn information about it, there's a very in-depth website. It's currently at sites.uab.edu/CSIopioids. I think we purchased the domain csiopioids.org, but I haven't tested to see if it works. But that one just explains the study. It's not so much a recruitment tool as a way to help people understand everything about who we are, all of our team members, who's funding us. It's open to non-veterans. This is explicitly open to people who lost someone who's not a veteran, even though the VA is paying for it. And then you can, in the frequently asked questions are there. From that site, there's a link to the entry survey, which is kind of a screener, but it's about 45 questions long. Some people dive in and they peel off after the first five questions. That's fine. There is a kind of brief informational sheet. If you go to that screener survey, you already know that's on a secure server. It is compliant with a load of different standards and cannot be accessed by anybody outside of a very restricted crew, and it's managed by the University of Alabama at Birmingham. But from the screener survey responses, we'll reach out to some and ask if those people would like to go further in the study. And there is a question at the end which says, would you like to be contacted about going further in the study? So that's part of how we're going to contact them. And then those people will have a chance to do a more elaborate informed consent, and they can decide if it is worth their time to work with us on trying to get medical records, which may not always be possible, and to do the in-depth interview, which is recorded. And again, extremely secure. There are loads and loads of rules and institutional review boards that govern every single thing we do, which is why this has taken a long time to launch. But anyway, the main website just to learn about it is sites.uab.edu/CSIopioids, and that's probably where to start.
Perfect. Dr. Kertész, thank you so much for your time. It's much appreciated.
Thank you so much, Jay.